Good afternoon. I'm Reverend Keith Cron, Director of the Transitions Office. I oversee ministerial transitions for our Unitarian Universalist Association, just starting my sixth year in this particular position. And here to talk to you about navigating ministerial transitions and the variety of ways and options to both think and proceed on how you do that. We used to have a very simple system. Your minister left, you got a new one. It was also a very different time. The sand did not shift as quickly as it used to for not only for congregations, but also for the wider world in general. And we're now living in a time where we are shifting far more quickly than we would have imagined. We're seeing how the world is changing, how the United States is changing, and how it thinks about religion, and how generationally things are different from those who are part of the generation where we went to church and contributed to church because that's what you do, to the next generation who are looking at church for, that's interesting, why are you do that? Why are you doing that? Can it make a difference in my life and the life of those around us? And that is a particular shift that Unitarian Universalism is facing, as we watch a whole lot of folks who have really built our churches begin to think about what it will mean to turn their church over to the next generation and how they will view Unitarian Universalism. And we're also watching in various ministries end. And we are looking at what could potentially be a shortage of ministers. How many of you were at the service of the Living Tradition last evening? 66 people walked across the stage, newly retired ministers. The year before that, 57 people walked across the stage as newly retired ministers. The three previous years before that, the average was 30. So we are looking at some shifting numbers here that may affect, indeed, how we look at ministerial transitions and what is ahead. And then there is what a congregation is looking for. Often as not, a congregation is looking for one of two kinds of new ministers. One who is either exactly the same as the previous minister they had, or one who is the exact opposite of the previous minister they had. Or if we get a more nuanced congregation, a congregation is looking for someone who isn't Minister X, but also brings this with them. And so often what we see happen, it's like, you know, our last minister was not strong at administration. So we're going to find a minister whose skills are really great in administration. And then they discover that the minister is not a particularly strong preacher. But they neglected to mention that what they really wanted was someone who was a really strong preacher. So we see sort of this flip-flop happen in terms of what we don't have, we want, and we forget the good things that we have. And it's important as we navigate ministerial transitions to remember both of those things. How many of you are currently now in a congregation undergoing some sort of ministerial transition? I would hope it would be almost all of you as you go through all of this. About 30 years ago, we really started looking at how to better help congregations begin to transition from one minister to another, because often what would happen is Minister X would leave, Minister Y would come in, and the congregation would discover Minister Y was not Minister X, actually did things differently, and they didn't like it. And so the idea was, if you have someone who will come in for a year and sort of help the congregation realize that their next minister isn't going to be the previous minister, the interim minister absorbs a whole lot of some of that anguish and disconcertedness as they move forward to the transition, so that when the new minister arrives, a year from later, there aren't the expectations. The story I like to tell about this, we forget how much becomes expected. I walked into a congregation who had had a minister for over 35 years. They were in their interim period, and I was leading the Sunday service that morning. And I talked with the lay leader about what I was going to do. I was going to do the opening words. I was going to light the chalice. I was going to do the children's time, a reading, and the sermon and the benediction. I go to light the chalice. There's this nice chalice with this Bic lighter right next to it, literally right on the chalice. It's like, okay, I pick it up, turn it on, and light the chalice. 200 people gasped in unison, because that was not how they lit the chalice. And then there was nervous laughter, and more people began laughing. But it had not even occurred to them to tell someone who wasn't from there, there are traditions that we do. They just assumed that I would know it. And this is often what happens to a new minister in a congregation. There is the assumption already that you know our culture, because this is how we have always done it. And so much a part of navigating ministerial transitions is about helping congregations begin to think that there may be other ways of doing things, or maybe other ways of looking at things, and maybe what they are doing isn't necessarily the best way to work. One of the generational challenges we're facing right now is that we have held up for a long time the model of the way church worked in the 1950s and 1960s. That things are great and this is how we're going to do them, and yet the world has changed significantly. We are no longer in an era where church is the only thing going on a Sunday morning. And there are other things that need to be considered. How many of you are currently in a congregation that has an interim minister? How many of you are getting ready for an interim minister to come to your congregation? How many of you know that a transition is coming within the next year or two? And know that's a possibility. Any of you currently with a developmental minister? Well, the one developmental minister raises his hand. Glad you did. I'll explain the terms. And by the way, the session is being recorded, so if you're not at a microphone, I will repeat things so that when people go back and listen to this, they will have an understanding of what was raised. Developmental ministry. As I was talking a little bit about the history, it used to be you just went from one minister to another. Then we went to interim ministry, which was really about creating a space so that the new minister didn't have to absorb all of the different expectations and changes. The other thing that we discovered is often the congregation had to either grieve or heal, depending on what happened in the previous ministry. Or move beyond a particular legacy that the minister had left. And one of the things that we discovered, and this is one of the mantras I've held for 6 years, is that sometimes it was better to do things well than it was to do them quickly. And a lot of congregations often needed more than 1 year of transitional work to make it happen. And more congregations moved toward 2 years of interim ministry. That started slowly. More and more congregations began to look at this as a real option, and today we've moved to 90% of congregations now doing 2 years of interim ministry. Interestingly enough, as an aside, congregations that do at least 2 years of interim ministry have had over the last 5 years a 90% success rate of finding a settled minister in their search. Congregations that have done 1 year of interim ministry have a 56% chance of finding a settled minister in their next search process. But not only did people discover that they needed more time in terms of doing the interim work, they just needed more time in helping a search committee do its work better. And I have noticed two very significant and important things about that. One of which is that search committees that become formed before the settled minister has exited often have more of a tie to that previous minister than one that has started after the settled minister has left. They still tend to be reactive to that particular settled ministry. Their model of ministry is only based on the previous settled minister. Whereas there is one of the two most important days in interim ministry is the first day that the interim minister is in the pulpit and the congregation realizes they are not going to go away. And not only is the interim minister not going away, but the congregation isn't going to go away. That things are going to keep moving on in the church and they begin to deal with the process of things may also be differently. Because all of a sudden the sermon is different than what they typically heard before from the previous settled minister. And that's often very important. And it's very important for the search committee because they then get a chance to experience some of the interim ministry that happens with the congregation. And one of the things that can happen for every search committee is that this group of about seven people become very isolated at a certain point from the rest of the congregation. So they have sometimes lost track of what has gone on in the congregation since they went into becoming a search committee. And so the congregation they are representing is one that is slightly out of touch from where the congregation is, because they haven't seen some of the changes that have happened during an interim time. The other thing that we're very aware of is that now ministers are asking in search, why did they only do 1 year of interim search? Since 2 years is the standard. And the corollary question, which sometimes comes up, are they trying to avoid doing work they need to do? Am I going to inherit things as a newly settled minister there that might be a little bit more problematic? But so much of it is really about giving the search committee good time to do its work. Often a congregation learns in April that their minister is leaving to a new congregation. And by the time the congregation gets an interim minister, and if they were even ready to begin to think about hiring a search committee, that new search committee is going to be behind the eight ball time-wise. And these are folks you really want to give time to do it. So we're seeing more congregations do 2 years of interim ministry. There are some congregations that realize we have a whole lot more work to do than 2 years of work. We have any number of things that we have sort of not paid attention to, any number of continual chronic problems that we need to deal with, any number of things that require us to spend some more time on them. These have led congregations to think about, okay, we need to do a different kind of transition, one that can last longer so that we can really spend our time focusing on these issues. For this, we have what we now call developmental ministry. And usually what happens, usually this is the most common scenario. It's not the only scenario. Usually these come after about a year of interim ministry. The interim minister is there and going, we have a significant amount of work to do that we're not going to be able to get done during the interim time. There are still lagging issues on stewardship, issues around ministerial authority and trust, concerns about the building and whether to stay in it or whether to move somewhere else, various issues that surface. So the interim minister will often recommend to the congregation that they consider a developmental ministry to spend a period of 3 to 5 years working on specific goals. And let's suppose that a congregation comes up with 3 specific goals. We then recommend that the developmental ministry be 3 years. The congregation comes up with 5 specific goals. We recommend that it be 5 years. Again, this falls under the mantra of do it well as opposed to do it quickly. These are goals you're not going to be able to check off a box and do in a month. They're going to take some time to figure out what is the best course of action. And sometimes it's just going to involve conversations so that people can all begin to get on the same page. What we are seeing now as we move, we are now 5 years into developmental ministry. We have had around 40 congregations do some sort of UUA Transition Office approved developmental ministry, because there are other congregations who are calling what they do developmental ministry that have not talked to us. And we have begun to see some trends in terms of what works and what doesn't in these developmental ministries. And what seems to be most important is that not only has the leadership agreed that these goals are important, but the congregation has also agreed that these goals are important. I've seen in the last couple of years a couple of congregations where the leadership was on board with it and the congregation wasn't, and so conflict emerged. Clearly one of their developmental goals should have been around authority and leadership. Chances are that's a chronic goal, a chronic thing that the congregation has needed to work on. The other thing that we have seen sort of evolve over time around developmental ministry is that developmental ministries are often more successful for the congregation when they know that it is going to be for a specific time and the minister does not have an opportunity to be called. And that's one of the learnings we've learned in particular over this last year. And the reason is there have been any number of congregations who have decided developmental ministry is a great way to try out a minister, to see if we like them or not, which is not the purpose of developmental ministry. But they see this as a way to not engage in the search process, to have someone recommended for them, and then to be able to say, yes, this person will work, or no, that it won't. And so where we have moved toward in future hires for developmental ministering from a congregation is that these really are more elongated transitional processes. Now, a developmental ministry can be extended if, for example, you have a congregation that's agreed to 3 goals, they get toward the end of those 3 years, and it's like, it's going to take us longer to do this, we need an additional year, or these have really surfaced other goals that we really need to work on. We have extended that. But in most cases, we are not recommending that a congregation look at the option of a call for a developmental minister. This is really about the congregation focusing on the work that it needs to do and knowing that the minister will leave at the end of a certain period of time. For many of these congregations, these are congregations where there has been some issues around authority, and in some cases, there has been some history of clergy misconduct in the past. And often one of the goals for a developmental ministry is about repairing the trust in ministry. That there was either clergy sexual misconduct or some other misconduct that happened within the congregation, so that often the congregation has a history of very short-term ministries. They call someone, and then a group of folks discover they don't like the minister, and within 3 to 4 years, the minister is gone. And we see that happen repeatedly throughout a congregation's period of time. And so it's clear that one of the issues that needs to happen is around rebuilding trust in the ministers and in ministry in general. And that's where we are with developmental ministry. Another form of transitional ministry that you can look at where you can view it as a tryout, assuming any minister will want to do that, is simply calling it a contract ministry. We will contract with a minister for a year, and we can mutually decide whether or not we can renew it. At a certain point, we can then look at the possibility, if it goes on for several years, whether we want to explore the possibility of calling this person as our minister. And part of it is we want congregations to be clear about what it is they want, so they're more likely to get something that meets their needs, and so that ministers, when they walk into a congregation, know what it is they're walking into. The greatest distress on the part of the ministers that I see is they think they're entering into a congregation that says it wants X and then discovers they really didn't. They wanted Y instead. In particular, when I entered into the office 5 years ago, I heard a lot of stories from ministers saying they told me they wanted to grow, but they really didn't. Or they told me they wanted to grow, and they meant it as long as everyone who walked through the door looked exactly like them, had the same theology, was about the same age, same politics. And the idea of us becoming more diverse in different kinds of ways was not something that we had bargained for. I had one congregation in New England in a town of about 1,200 people tell me, yes, we want to grow, but we only want people from our town to be the people who help grow the church. This was a congregation that had been around for over 200 years. And it's like, well, you know, that's probably not going to happen. If you want to grow, it's going to have to be beyond your particular community. But that's sort of the difference for a contract minister. It's like we want someone. We're thinking about growing, but we really want to make sure we've gotten the basics covered for preaching, pastoral care, maybe board, board meetings, maybe some other function within in the congregation. Just to be clear, the most important quality in any kind of ministerial search is clarity. What do you want? Who you are? Where do you want to go? And that often takes a while for a congregation to figure out. Because often the congregation and the minister have been going on autopilot for a while. If you have a minister who has been waiting for kids to graduate from high school, if you have a minister who's been moving more toward retirement, you may have everyone sort of going into what I refer to as a Rip Van Winkle church. It's sort of things have sort of been going on for a while. And that takes a while to sort of move past and toward. And we may in fact begin to see other kinds of ministerial transitions too. One of the things that happened this year, which may continue to happen in a variety of ways in the future, we had two congregations about an hour and a half from each other, both at around 100 members, realizing that the sustenance of full-time ministry was an incredible hardship on the church. So the two congregations have decided to work together and share one interim minister. We may see this in particular. I was talking with one of our regional staff people this week about four congregations within 2 hours of each other. All four of them want a three-quarter time minister. And what I suggested was maybe they would do better if they considered the option of paying two ministers at full time really well than looking at who they might be able to find for a three-quarter time ministry position on their own. Again, that's one of the ways that the sands has shifted. Everyone has sort of assumed because we're a congregation, we therefore can have our own minister, regardless whether it's quarter time, half time, three-quarter time, or full time. And we may have to begin to look differently at that. And the interesting idea of having four congregations working together with two ministers could be quite a fascinating thing. A chance for an immediate learning between all of the congregations, and to have two ministers who are working together on behalf of all four congregations could, in fact, produce more things. So those are all sort of things that you think about in terms of navigating ministerial transition. But one other thing I'd like to add before we move into a time of questions and answers is to talk about how your congregation approaches the transition time. And I have seen this make more of a difference than anything else. The congregation that is open to the interim time being different, that sees possibilities for new beginnings, new starts, letting things go, that sees, yes, there are probably some things that we as a congregation have to work on, are the congregations that not only make the best use of the interim time, they're the congregations that do the best in the ministerial search. The congregations that like to think that we really don't have a problem, we really just need to move on to the next minister, often are caught by surprise. Often these are the folks who are more likely to not like their interim minister because they're actually making them do some work and believe that little good is coming out of it. So how you approach the interim or developmental time actually will affect the way that the ministry goes. And chances are, for any of you in tradition, how many of you have heard the question, why do we even need an interim minister? Why can't we just get another minister instead? Congregation in Fresno, California, just completed 2 years of interim ministry. The chair of the search committee, on the day that they called Tim Kutzmark as their newly settled minister, was approached by a woman in the congregation who said, you may remember that I was one of the people who said, why do we have to have another minister? Why can't we just get another minister? And I didn't realize until this moment that I could not be this happy about calling a new minister if I hadn't had time to sort of let go and grieve about the new ministry, open myself up to new possibilities, begin to think about what our church could be now as opposed to the way that it was for me to be this happy. And the process of change just takes time. And I think that's very important. I would like to ask you, if you are going to ask questions, to come up to the microphone, to state your name, where your congregation, what congregation you're a part of, and then ask whatever question you would like.
Hello, my name is this on? I'm Elaine Jers, and I'm from the UU Fellowship of Center County, Pennsylvania, where Penn State University is. And
oh, I'm glad you're first. You made me think of two other things that I wanted to say.
Oh, okay. All right. Is that better?
Yes. Speak right into the mic.
Okay. Okay. Did everybody hear I'm from Penn State? Okay. We are in the very fortunate position in our fellowship of having our minister, who we have loved for 15 years, retire, and having coming in an interim minister who she was our first choice and we were her first choice. So we're very happy about that. So I'm wondering, what would you say to people who are worried about the possibility that they're going to become really attached to their interim minister and grieve when that person leaves?
Well, there are multiple reasons why people grieve their interim minister leaving. In your case, because I immediately thought of two different trajectories. If they have a previous settled minister that they loved and they grieved that person leaving, and then they have an interim minister come who they loved and grieved that person leaving, to any prospective minister, that's an indication that this congregation actually likes ministry. That's actually a really good sign, and that's just normal. I have, however, seen congregations that like their interim ministers more than they like their settled ministers, and that's because they know they're coming pre-fired and that they're only going to be there for a short period of time. Every interim minister goes into a congregation knowing they are going to leave. And in fact, the act of leaving a congregation is one of the most important acts a minister ever does. That's not what I was going to say, and hopefully I'll remember to come back to my other point. But I do want to talk about this for a second. This is why it's important. Congregations will remember how the ministry went as much by how the minister left than any other thing that they did during their ministry. What I now counsel with people as they're leaving, once they've announced, now is your time to talk to people, to let them say their goodbyes, to let that help them move through the transitional time. It is not the time to worry about your legacy. If you worry about your legacy now, you've blown it. Your legacy will be created by the connections that people have with you. And that's just vitally important. And congregations that have gone through a negotiated ending, for example, where the minister was negotiated out, they take a lot longer to heal than congregations where the ending is more civil and even welcomed in different kinds of ways. So where we have seen congregations prefer interims over settled ministers, it's usually because there's been some sort of history of misconduct on the part of the minister. It's like, we know we're going to get rid of this person. We don't know when we're going to get rid of the settled minister. And it's not that conscious, it's all unconscious, but we see that all the time. Consider yourself in a good place. Here's what I want to say, because State College made me think about it for some reason. In addition to thinking about the changes that are going on in your congregation, think about the changes that are going on in your wider community. Because the ground sort of changed significantly in State College over the last couple of years. And those kinds of things have a significant effect. And I'll tell you a quick story, and then Ralph, I'll let you speak next. One of our congregations, it was discovered that a member of the congregation with a partner and child was a known pedophile, arrested, made significant news. The minister and the religious educator were the rocks of the congregation during this particular time. Everything seemed like it was going well until the minister announced her departure. And then all of a sudden, to many in the congregation, the bedrock that had helped get them through this particularly unsettled time in the community was leaving, and people panicked. So it is not only what happens in your congregation that matters, but what happens in your wider community that can happen as well. Ralph.
Hi, thank you, Keith. I'm Ralph Miro. I'm a retired UU minister. My wife is also a retired UU minister, and I am struck by how different things are today from when I was seeking my first position as a minister 50 years ago. When I started, first of all ministers were men. We were young, mostly in our 20s, and we had wives and often babies. And we were the primary wage earner for the family. Today, increasingly, ministers come with partners who often earn more than they do in whatever profession they're in. This complicates the settlement process for the minister, because the partner will also likely be facing a job change, and their opportunities may be limited in this new area. I'm thinking of one situation where the partner was a physician, leaving a practice that had been the primary source of income for the family. I live now in a New England community that is known for many nice things, but one not so nice thing is the quality of our public schools. People with elementary school age children or middle school children often must pay what I think are enormous sums to have their kids in acceptable private or charter schools. So as you think about what your community, what your church offers the minister that you'd like to have, you have to also think about what the community will offer to the partner and what the various resources of the community will mean to that family. It's getting increasingly complicated.
And Ralph was not a plant, but thank you. I have to say I see this all the time. When congregations are going through transition, I strongly encourage to make sure that the partner can come and visit the congregation when there are pre-candidating visits, because often you're selling the partner on the location as much as you're selling the minister on the location. We have more and more ministers who are geographically bound to particular areas because they can't move because of their particular partners, or what they have agreed on is they can move maybe once. This down in the future, this may actually get better, simply because more and more of work doesn't have to happen in a particular place. But for right now, it is a significant problem. And I would say, for those ministers who are partnered in some sort of way, over half of them, they are now the second income in their household.
Hi, I'm Rick Kreitzer from First UU of Columbus, Ohio. And this got me really thinking, and I just want to ask you to do a little compare and contrast with many churches are going to board governance, and that, as I understand it, most came from nonprofits, other nonprofits. Well, going and having interims doesn't usually happen in profit or nonprofits. You know, okay, we have a change in leadership, and we want to let people get time to adjust and all this. You get someone new comes in and just starts. So I'm wondering what, if you think nonprofits should be doing the same thing, and how it's, if not, how it's different than congregations.
For nonprofits, let me just talk about that briefly for a second. For nonprofits, there often isn't the emotional attachment to a particular person that there is to the minister. People often get very emotionally attached to their minister because the director of the nonprofit doesn't marry your child, doesn't bury your spouse, and those kinds of connections really sort of deepen a particular relationship. And I mean, often when a congregation goes into search, the elders in a particular congregation, their primary question in looking at a particular minister is, am I going to be okay with this person burying me or burying my partner? And going back to policy governance and board governance, which I think is important, any number of interims will come in and help a congregation begin to think about this if they haven't been thinking about it before. They may also come in and be a reminder for the congregation that not every minister interacts with policy governance in the same way. And often there are shifts that need to happen based on the styles of the particular minister.
Hi, Keith. My name is Dana. I'm with East Shore in Bellevue, Washington. You're waiting for me. So I have a couple of questions on the interim minister. The first one is the healing piece, if you could just speak briefly to the congregational piece that the minister would work us through the healing for our congregation losing the associate minister and then our minister upcoming. And then the second piece tied to the interim minister is I just want to get a feel for how many congregations are going through this right now. This is kind of a Darwinian question. How many are going through this right now? What's the pecking order? What kind of search process do you do to pick and choose where interim ministers go, where that best fit is? I get that there's size and demographics and the location, location, location. But if you could just speak to how we get to be part of that process of choosing, the right fit for us.
Right.
So the healing and that.
Right, right. Healing and selection. Let me talk about the healing first. Anytime there's an ending of different kind, regardless of the kind, rather, some interesting things are going to surface. One of which is the congregation is either going to discover or see how clearly not everyone in the congregation has the same opinion of the minister that just happened. If you had a minister who's been negotiated out, one of the things that has often happened is that sides have been formed. And a piece of the healing that needs to happen is that the two sides need to be reconnected in some kinds of way. Sometimes that happens, sometimes it doesn't, depending on how deep the divisions were. But the interim minister will often come in and work with the congregation and try and help the congregation as a overall whole get out of its rigid thinking. Minister X was bad. Minister X was good. So if you come up to me and say, I really hated Minister X, I might ask you as the interim minister, okay, was there anything you liked about him? No. Okay, when you think about something you like about him, tell me. But just to try and get people, one of the things that happens during particularly conflicted times is that people get more and more rigid. And more rigid they get, the less they are likely to move in any particular way. So often what an interim person does is he helps people, or she helps people, or they help people move out of a place of rigidity and into a place of more openness, which I think is important. Often the interim minister there is also to help them heal, to be able to go, you will move on. And so often what happens for a congregation, for those of you who are starting and going to be looking for a minister in the next couple of years, do not lose sight of the fact that whoever you select, call, hire, whichever route you end up going for your next minister, at some point that minister will leave too. And we've been trying to educate our ministers to think about that as well. I sent out an email to all of the ministers who were just placed this year. Don't lose sight of the fact that someday you will leave this congregation. And I think that's important. In terms of the selection, the way the process generally works, and there are always variables, is that all of the ministers who've applied for an interim ministry position fill out an application. We place those in a Dropbox, which we give ministers a password to. The ministers tell us which interim positions they are interested in. We will send a certain number of names out. We will send up to 8 names if a congregation wants as many as 8 names for to look at. And then the committee goes through a 2-week process where they discern who it is they'd be willing to ask. And usually it's more than one person because the ministers are also looking at more than one congregation for the most part. And if it doesn't work out in the first round, we move on to a second and then in the third. One of the things that happened this year because of numbers, the number of ministers willing to serve in interim congregations actually was fewer than the number of interim congregations that were out there. So I put out information to retired ministers. I put out information to community ministers. Put out information to settled ministers, letting them know what positions were open and if they were interested in this, to please talk to me. We may have a record number of people who are new to ministry doing interim ministry in the upcoming year. That's not necessarily a bad thing. Everyone gets trained in all of that. But ideally, the congregation will have some selection. Sometimes timing comes into play. If a resignation happens after the interim ministry has started, the numbers may be smaller. And sometimes, in particular, for congregations with particular history or demographics or sizes, I will go and recruit or encourage people to consider applying for a particular congregation. For example, we probably wouldn't want a new minister who's done their internship in a congregation of 100 going and be the interim minister in a congregation of 600. That might be a little bit overwhelming for that particular person. So we try and do some matching and get people matched up in particular ways. And I do a lot of coaching of the ministers in general to think about congregations, to give them as much information as they can so that they can make the decision. Unless we are like bone dry at this point, or unless the congregation asks, because a congregation may ask to have an interim recommended for them. I try and provide as much opportunity as possible for the congregation to decide who will be their interim minister. The stories, this is now my 29th General Assembly. The stories from when I became a layperson in the 80s was that congregation would get their list of ministers, and it was clear only one was interested in serving them, and these were all selected by the Department of Ministry. We have now moved away from that particular system and more to, if you are interested in serving a particular congregation, we will let the congregation decide as opposed to you all deciding. We've done that for 17 years for the settled search. We've moved that in the last 5 years also around the interim search.
Great. You made me think of other questions.
Name?
Kendra Munz.
I'm a member of Venice, Florida.
Speak in, because I think people are having a hard time hearing you.
My name is Kendra Munz. I'm a member of the Venice, Florida congregation, and I have a dual membership. I'm in Falmouth, Massachusetts, and I was asked to come here by Falmouth last Sunday to take notes, which I'm taking extensively. They are going to start the interim process, and they're losing a minister they've had for 15 years, who is coming to Florida, by the way.
Yes.
It's great. Anyway, Tarpon Springs, that needs a minister. So it's a win-win. But I took notes on their order of service, and I don't have it with me, but the two things I remember they do want, they're hoping to find a minister, an interim minister, who has experience in interim ministry already. So not someone who's never done interim ministry before. So someone who's familiar with the process and can really help them. And two, they're hoping to find someone who can start in August or this fall. There were a couple other things, but I've forgotten, and I hope I can get in touch with you later if I talk to them again and find out. But this is a great congregation, and of course, we're talking Falmouth, Massachusetts folks on Cape Cod. So hopefully this will have some attraction, even though they did have a lot of snow with other people in New England this year. But normally, it's not as much snow as Boston or the area.
Right, because you're on the water.
But anyway, they're a great congregation. Could I possibly follow up with you afterwards if I talk to them again and find out? Because
sure.
They're a good congregation. They're my second congregation. I contribute to both, and I may not be able to stay for this entire thing because I have to do something in preparation for our workshop tomorrow at 3, the one on the 20th Amendment.
Sure.
But okay, thank you so much.
And congregations enter late into the process, and that's just a part of what we do as best we can. I have come to believe, you made me think, I've come to believe that the UUA operates two different settlement systems. There's one we operate for the United States and Canada, and one we operate for Greater Boston. And they truly function differently. And the reality is, just because we have 140 congregations basically in eastern Massachusetts, we have a whole lot of ministers sitting around there, that you all are in better shape than if you were in Bozeman, Montana, at this particular point, because there are ministers who cannot leave the area.
Good afternoon. Karen Lynn, First Parish in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I think...
Speaking of the settlement system of Greater Boston, yes.
our senior minister announced a week ago that he was resigning and leaving at the end of September. We're, I think, a very healthy congregation, but we're in a huge period of transition. We lost our associate minister of color last December, and we've just approved this humongous initiative to turn our basement into a homeless shelter. We really need a good interim, and we are aware of the shortage of interim ministers, and we are aware that we're off the standard calendar. So there is considerable anxiety and anger about the timing of this decision. So I would like you to, I would like to ask you, number one, are our anxieties about finding a good interim well-founded? I think you might have possibly answered that a little bit. And second, what can I do as a congregational leader to make these next 3 months, two of which are in the summer when a lot of people go away, most productive? Thank you.
I'm going to speak philosophically for a moment. One of the interesting problems that we in the Central Conference of American Rabbis have we are in the same boat on this together, is that by and large, we offer a one time of year settlement process. Most of our full-time positions end in the summer, and new positions start August 1st. No other denomination does this. A part of that is a relation to our size. Part of it, interestingly enough, is our tie to sort of the academic calendar in a way that other denominations aren't necessarily as tied to. I have long been an advocate that while we can't handle, like our colleagues at the United Church of Christ or the Lutherans or some other liberal Protestant nation can, in any time of year settlement system, we just simply do not have the number of congregations and ministers to support that. We can and should offer a twice a year settlement process. And I'll tell you why I say that. If a ministry needs to end, it should end, period, for whatever reason. I have watched ministries over the last 5 years where people have tried to drag things out because of the calendar, and that has not served anyone particularly well. Sometimes the better of the two options is to try and figure out something as a stopgap measure and let the ministry end, as opposed to minister and congregation driving each other crazy, because I've actually seen that make things worse. And so when someone knows it's time for them to go, I would trust them on that. And summer, how many of you now, I'd be intrigued by this, how many of you have congregations where the church still shuts down for the entire summer? Completely. That this is an interesting change. 20 years ago, half of you would have had your hands up. How many of you pretty much have nothing but lay-led services during the summer? 20 years ago, this would have been most of you. How many of you have ministers preaching in July and August now? Your own minister. Have had your own minister preaching in July and August. 20 years ago, that would have been almost no one. We are slowly moving away from an academic year to a more all-year, but that is still slow. You are, in some ways, benefiting from being in Greater Boston. You are also, and here's one of the most, one of the more interesting things, you are also benefiting because you're Cambridge. You have caught people's attention in ways that even Falmouth, for example, wouldn't have caught. Because it is a place people value thinking about and look at. Now, I don't know who eventually is going to apply, but I've had more calls about Cambridge and what they're doing and potentially being the interim minister than I have about some congregations that were on cycle, paying more, and had more members. I mean, that's what I mean by offering two different settlement cycles. People are going to get mad. They're going to grieve. They're going to feel sad. That's inevitable. I think it's important for you and other leaders in the congregation to sort of understand this kind of has to happen. The only way out is through. And there is no sidestepping this, which is so often so what people need to do. And because it's a Cambridge church, it will move forward and it will recover. And it's important that you as a community are there for one another as you move forward. And that a year, 2 years from now, you'll be looking in a positive direction as opposed to this sudden sort of announcement, this sudden surprise, this moment of seeming trauma of, wait a minute, you know, the world as we know it has significantly changed. What do we do about it? And whenever you go into your settled search, you'll have 40 people apply for the position, which will be more than any other congregation in the movement.
I'm Pat Caffrey. Can you hear me okay? Pat Caffrey, Second Unitarian Church, Omaha, Nebraska. We're very excited. We're starting our second year of interim ministry. And in the last 6 months, our board chair has been in conversation with Reverend Cron, and we've also, the board has had a conference Skype call with Dory from the Mid-America region that culminated in the annual meeting where the congregation made a decision to move forward with developmental ministry. And I think maybe not out of the two categories that were primarily the reasons given, but really because we want to move forward with clarity and commitment. So that's the question. If you can think about your experiences, you know, and I know how important it is to have the church identify who we are, and that's kind of the work we're going to start doing in the summer and the fall, and then coming up with these goals that really need to be clear and concrete. And if there's out of these 40 congregations that are currently experiencing this, if you might be able to share a little bit about, you know, how that came about and what that really looked like.
Right. I mean, the goals, we want you to be as specific as possible and specific to things that the congregation can work on. Let me give you an example. One congregation who entered the developmental search a year and a half ago was very clear that one of their developmental goals was the minister would preach good sermons. And I looked at them and went, that's not something you can work on. I want you to come up with goals that you as a congregation can work on. Interestingly enough, they came back to me and said, well, we can tell the minister what's a good sermon or not, so we can work on that. And I said, that's not developmental ministry. That's minister is dartboard. I want you to think about things in terms of not even something as generic as we want to grow, but to have us take a look at what are the barriers that are keeping us from growing and what are the practices that we can institute that will improve the odds that we'll grow. What are the conversations we need to have to get us to think about this in different kinds of ways? We have had a long-standing conflict about one congregation's goal was about how much intergenerational things should happen within the congregation. And that's something they wanted the developmental minister to help them to think about, and what would be family-friendly and still respectful of the people who did not want to be around children all the time. That's a very common tension, interestingly enough, in many of our congregations. So the more specific you can get around particular things, we often see things about buildings in terms of, do we keep our building? Do we go to a new building? How is our location hurting us? How do we better describe, how do we figure out how to do social justice within our congregation? What are the things where we specifically need to work on? The other interesting thing about that, whatever you come up with, the minister is not only going to help you work on that, they're going to begin to look at some of the underlying things that are going on beneath it. What are some of the things that have led to this? And it may be that the reason you're not growing is because there's been a history of conflict avoidance within the congregation. So the minister may help the congregation begin to think of new ways that they can actually talk about this, bring in appreciative inquiry, bring in some other kinds of models. The congregation may have, may need, for example, to create its first disruptive behavior policy, because there is a group of people in the congregation who have decided that the person who's driving away 40 members is more important to keep in the congregation than the 40 people who left. So whatever goals you will come up with, they are great starting places for not only that kind of work, but for work that goes deeper. And one of the other reasons why we like to do this, and they do have an interim minister in Lincoln, with an interim minister there, is the interim minister can help you think about these goals as you come up with them.
Hello, I'm Karen Paul from Miami. And our Unitarian Universalist congregation is in a phase of transition right now. But we have voted overwhelmingly, like 99%, to hold off on applying for the interim minister right now. part of that is because interim ministers seem to have a very hard time settling into Miami. The cost of living there is very high. By the way, I'm a college professor, so I see this with assistant professors too. Just the overhead of moving to a place where, number one, nearly everybody you interact with speaks Spanish. The traffic is horrible. You know, we have hurricanes, and the cost of living. It, by the time the interim minister gets settled and able to devote their attention to our affairs, the year is half over already, and they've had a lot of bad experiences. And I wondered if you could comment about that, and if you've seen that other places, and if you can give us some helpful hints.
One of the most interesting things that I do see happen a lot is we don't realize how important our culture is in a particular congregation until someone from somewhere else, particularly a minister, comes in from another congregation. It is often a surprise. Ministers who have been in the center of the country, as opposed to on the coast, often go through a period of sticker shock. People who come in from a smaller place to a larger place often have to deal with how different time is managed in larger cities than they do in smaller places. And it does become an adjustment. It's also another reason why we often recommend 2 years of interim ministry for most congregations, because while the congregation is going through some of its grief and healing, the minister is adjusting as well. And there are some congregations where taking a year off from ministry in general may help some folks move to a place where they appreciate ministry more than if they just go and get another one. And I'm beginning to see that too. I mean, where it's like, for whatever reason, things have not worked out, and there are people within the congregation, because it's never the entire congregation, it's usually a group within the congregation, who sort of needs to realize how we function without as a way to understand the need for why we have someone. And I think that's particularly important. You can generally count on in those situations that the congregation will do some regression. There will be some contraction back into a smaller way of functioning, a different way of seeing of the world. And one of the pitfalls of this is that some of the voices who believe that ministry may not be important will get louder. And because they will say, sure, we can do this, while the people who are running the church get more and more exhausted. And sometimes we can see more tension in some of those congregations. So if you are going to do without ministry for a certain period of time, if the leadership can come up with a specific plan, that can often be helpful in terms of what we are going to do about ministry next. And the other thing, and I talked about how culture is so important. You explaining your culture to potential ministers is absolutely crucial. Because Miami is not even Fort Lauderdale, is not even Tarpon Springs, is not even Venice. And people may only think Florida and hurricanes in terms of understanding that Miami is literally the capital, the unofficial capital of all of Latin America. And that has a different impact on how congregational life there plays out. And then the question becomes, as it has for so many different places, is the congregation truly a part of that culture, or have they created an oasis from that culture, which we've seen happen in other kinds of places? This is where working with your regional staff person, I think, is very important. To help make sure that there are opportunities for the congregation to continue and to dialogue about some of these things as you move forward, because otherwise the regression can be so significant that the amount of work that needs to be done becomes really huge.
Matt Aspen from Westside Unitarian Universalist in Seattle, Washington. I was just on the search committee that selected our, by the third round, our interim minister. And for those of you that are coming into the process, I want to let you know that you will be very well supported by the UUA. You will be very well supported if you are coming into this process by the UUA. It was a daunting process going through three rounds, but it's been very supportive. So my question is, one of our bigger, as big a challenge of losing our longtime 15-year, very beloved minister who helped grow the congregation from 80 to about 235 is that we purchased a building and we are now going through that yin-yang pull, push and pull of, are we really a program-sized church and is that what we really want? Because to do that, to maintain that building, that's what we're going to need to grow into. And so my question is, are interim ministers, is their only charge to listen to what the congregation wants, or do they try to help guide towards where, okay, good, you've answered my question. There you go. I'm just excited about the growth that I'm hearing about in this week.
I've had this conversation with several interim ministers, including several longtime interim ministers. And the model for interim ministry used to be you come in, you observe what happens, you name the elephant in the living room that no one was willing to talk about. That's now old-time interim ministry. New-time interim ministry is about you come in, you find out what's going on, you see where the congregation needs help. You don't have to be the person who is the answer, but you can be the person who connects them to the resources that can help them think about the answer. So what Beatrice may do for you in West Seattle is figure out who in the region can we come in to help the leadership really think about this, talk about this, and move forward with a plan. And it's not the old model of ministry where the minister is a generalist who knows everything, because ministers are constantly talking to each other, trying to get resources, figuring out who can best serve a particular congregation with what kind of resources and what way, so that when you have someone like an interim minister, you are actually getting the wisdom, ideally, if the interim minister is good, of 100 other interim ministers and regional staff people who are supporting the congregation through the process. So do not assume that the interim minister is going to be the only particular solution to whatever is going on in your congregation. Think of them as a gateway for additional solutions as you move forward. And the role of interim ministry now is to help the congregation look ahead as opposed to sort of look behind.
Hi, my name is Jamie Gibson. I'm on the board of All Souls in Brattleboro, Vermont. I have essential tremors, so I tend to shake. Through no fault, I hope of my own, I've become somewhat of an expert in ministerial transition. I moved to Portland, Maine, as the congregation there was transitioning. We got an interim minister, and the whole process worked wonderfully, and they got a wonderful settled minister. Then moved to Vermont, and I was at a congregation in Norwich, Vermont. We got an interim minister, and she died before the end of the process. And we got a wonderful minister. I'm going to call her a contract minister. I'm not sure if that's officially what she was or not, but just an amazing person. Then moved to Brattleboro, Vermont, where their minister of 12 years left. And we got an interim minister, and for personal reasons, she is leaving before the end of the interim process. At the same time, we've had a graying of the congregation, so that basically the congregation is shrinking through death. The building is at the top of a hill that has a dirt road, which needs constant care. The building itself was based on a model from the Southwest, which doesn't work all that well in the Northeast. So we have a number of issues, and we've decided to go with a developmental minister. But at the same time, especially with the harsh winter we had, we couldn't afford a three-quarter time, so we're trying to drop down to a half time. And it's becoming quite a process to even get somebody to apply.
Let me talk about that for a minute. Thank you. there is the constant struggle now in our congregations for what can we afford and what can we afford well. And I totally get the struggle, and you should only, I would rather you have a three-quarter time minister who can be paid well than a full-time minister who's paid poorly. And by the way, if you have a three-quarter time minister, I strongly recommend to both the minister of the congregation that the easiest way to help everyone understand what a three-quarter time minister does is that they work 3 weeks and then they have 1 week off. Because that's, people get that. But I will give you some numbers. And this isn't from this year, but it's from last year for the settled search process. Any congregation that was looking for a settled minister for a full-time position or more had at least 8 different ministers apply for those positions. If it was three-quarter time, they averaged 3 to 4 ministers actually apply. If it was less than three-quarter time, they were lucky to get 1 to 2, and usually 1. Unless you have someone who is already bivocational and coming into the area already with a private practice in social work or something like that, the idea of looking at a half-time ministry is going to be more and more complicated. And we're still looking for Brattleboro. I haven't given up hope yet, because usually someone will apply. In fact, I've got 3 people considering it. But just know, as you're making your decisions, for those of you who are trying to figure out what percentage of time you can afford, this affects how many people will actually be interested. Because in some ways, it's similar to the Miami situation in terms of, can people afford to live in a particular area?
How realistic is
sharing ministry? Here's where I think sharing ministry. It is more possible now than it was even a year ago, and I think the sand is going to continually shift, so that it's going to become more possible. I was having a conversation with one of our regional staff in the South, 4 congregations, 3-time ministers. Let's get them to share 2 full-time ministers and pay them well. I think that's going to be more attractive to ministers than looking at a three-quarter time ministry where they're trying to figure out whether they can live there or not. But it's going to take a couple of years for that shift to happen even more. We have time for these last 3 questions, and then technically we're over. If any of you need to leave, please slip out quietly, but we'll take these 3 questions.
Okay, and I'll keep it brief. My name is Darlene Johnsrud, and I'm a longtime member of a small fellowship in the state of Washington. We recently had a sad experience with the developmental ministry process, and I just would like to tell you all about it. So if you try this and it can work, you do it properly.
They can't hear you.
Our congregation, we did not, I think, fully inform people and define developmental ministry. So everybody sort of had their own take on it. Oh, it's sort of like living together for 3 years, and if you like each other, you can get married. That's, you know, more or less simplistic definition people were quoting. So our minister, I think it was his first church, as far as I know, I served on his committee on ministry, and actually I like the man, but he had the most undiplomatic approach to a new ministry. He plunged in with changes that were very foreign and new to us and quarreled with the committee chairs who did not agree to execute these changes immediately, and the fight was on. So when you're in that position, I did not feel like criticizing him, except in meetings when I would tell him about it directly. But we were all of us on the committee, getting complaints from other people about this undiplomatic approach. And often people would say, so what is this developmental ministry thing? Everybody should have known that before we ever engaged in it. And that's one of the reasons it failed. But it's a different thing. People aren't used to it, and you need to prepare people very well before you engage in it.
Thank you. Last question.
Sure, Donnie, a question. I was hoping that you might. You have another session tomorrow, I believe.
Tomorrow I have what is called the search committee breakfast for people from search committees.
And that hasn't been publicized real
well. It's a private event for congregations just with search committees.
Okay. Well, there's some people that...
If you're on a search committee and you don't know about it, come see me. Thank you all for being here. We'll be happy to work with you as you move through the transition. Just a touch.